Hello, this is the 11th full-length segment of Mystic Babylon Poetry Podcast. Today there are two poets besides me. These two poets are George and Paul Watzke. I have seen the elder Paul Watzke at many different open mics, and he posted a comment on one of the Mystic Babylon Poetry segments, which is where I heard of him first. He is going to be one of the featured readers June 27th at the 3300 Club in the Mission District in San Francisco. Paul Watzke's main interests in poetry are in Japanese poetry, such as the more well-known form of Japanese poetry, haiku, in its adapted form in English. He has numerous books out, and his works have appeared in Poetry Flash and other publications. His website is www.paulwatzkepoetry.com. The Watzke part of the URL is spelled W-A-T-S-K-Y. George Watzke reads with the organization Youth Speaks, has been a finalist and winner of many poetry slams, has appeared at the Apollo Theater in New York, and has a debut poetry collection and CD, Undisputed Backtalk Champion, available at the moment from First Word Press. Youth Speaks is located at www.youthspeaks.org. I will put the two aforementioned links on the Mystic Babylon podcast page so you won't have to remember them. The two poets will probably introduce themselves in more detail when they read. Please, I must remind you, support this podcast by buying the reader's books. They will be forever indebted. As I have said, my book that I read from is Spirits of Bondage and Inherent Transcendence, and you can buy it almost anywhere on the net. It is a very large 8x11, 224-page illustrated book of poetry. The poetry segment will start shortly. I, John Rhodes, will read first. The first poem I will read is Psychosomatic Fear in the Mountains, which echoes the well-known feeling of many a young person of living in ignorance of the fall, in the sense that many times we think that very little is wrong when actually, as our lives develop, something huge is wrong. Fear becomes an awesome thing. Just to be honest, this poem was from my younger years when I indulged freely in psychedelics. I have since learned that fears that I had had about the dangers of drugs back then seemed insignificant, but are now much bigger and obvious. My now sober fears echo the awareness of the dangers of the risks that we took back then with unguided drug taking. Here is the poem. In and around the mountains we drive. My mind flickers with fear and instability as we drive over the rugged and dangerous mountain by the lake. I secretly hoped I wouldn't fall into the lake like the Lake of Fire, even though it was quite placid. I felt strong by the mountains. I could feel its winds like the mountain's breath. I wish the wind would have whispered to me, "Be careful, my paths are dangerous." My soul felt slightly moved as we drove over the hazardous road. I could feel my limitedness when I compared my soul to the power of the mountain. As I shuddered at the cliffs, I felt as if the mountain shuddered with me. It was as though if I and the jeep and I was in were to fall, the whole mountain would fall. The mountain looked big and tall, but somehow fragile, as if were I to leave the mountain overnight, it would tumble down in a fright. It was as if God could knock us both down with his bare hands. Thank you. The second poem, Fortuitous Acts, is a complaint I wrote about mankind being able to claim things as natural disaster or even accidental or fortuitous. When will they catch the culprits in the henhouse? Here is the poem. Doom appears more accidental and fortuitous, but it is equally amiss, even if compared with the doom or misfortune born of ingeniously sly design that throws its victims into the abyss. The former causes desperation, and the latter causes bliss. When something is poorly done, a person is held accountable and accused, but for originality in crime, the perpetrator is many times excused, and is given exception even though he had put up a ruse, and his prey he had abused. The cleverness of the sly fox is not taken into account by the farmer, only the ineptness of the fox when it gets caught in the henhouse. The allies of evil will do the dirty work for the wicked foe, and they will help mute the mouth of those who suffer the pains that only their wounded souls will know. They cover up the inventiveness of the meek and the lowly, and when they are tortured, they make them forget that goodness they reap even as they sow. Even though the wicked person's name might be Jim or Joe, he has to utter an anonymous statement when they ask him why he stooped to act so dirty and to crime, never say no. He spoke, and his voice went down low, and answering as to why he did such a crime, he said, "Wouldn't John Doe?" If man never planned with his soul to rise above his acts to some high goal, man would be crawling on the ground forever like a mole. Why don't they just doubly punish the man once for remorse and once because he stole the life so selfishly of some innocent soul? Thank you. This last poem, Triumph Over Condition, compares man to mouse and how man has a lot in common with the mouse, or at least B.F. Skinner thinks so, the psychologist who taught us about human conditioning. Maybe these views are all lies, but why does man keep learning so many important lessons, much like the mouse does in his maze? I am, though not a behaviorist, but tend to think that there are many ways to look at the human condition, and this is one of them. Here is the poem. Beyond instinct is gnawing doubt, which only the conditioned mouse knows about. The mouse is small like mankind's house, but triumph over condition is something that they both can espouse. It is true that anima many times rules over the spirit of the ego gone astray, but as soon as one knows everything upon one's tray, one finds time to transcend one's own condition and pray, finding completely new circumstance, a new way. Many stipulate that instinct is primal, and that there is not even a spirit to stop one from thinking evil and make one think. But eventually, like stars in the sky, one will eventually look at error and blink. When man achieves self-mastery, he is much like the mouse, who through conditioning from his supposed master takes one step up to king, no longer a louse. Completeness and mastery of self is much like gaining the freedom of the stars in the sky. Even though one must keep the knowledge of identity bound in books that are on the shelf, one will not in this way in egotism delve. One will always reach to the high shelf, and from the stars their secrets try to pry. When man no longer considers that the only condition of life is that of dying, he will no longer accept the effort to rise above condition is itself a farce and is like an irrational lie. Thank you.
Hi, I'm George Watsky. As was said, I represent an organization called Youth Speaks. You can visit our website at www.youthspeaks.org, or you can visit my personal website at www.georgewatsky.com. I'm going to be reading three poems from my poetry collection, Undisputed Backtalk Champion, available from First Word Press. The first poem is the title piece of the book, Undisputed Backtalk Champion. I know what you're thinking, and yes, I do work out. You may find this hard to believe, but I was not always the mentally muscle pencil pusher you see flexing his mind before you. You see, back in the day I was super, super lightweight back-talking elementary school teacher's champion. With one raise of my scrawny arm, I could hit Mrs. Ames with the colloquial plural of octopus, list every Venezuelan vice president in reverse alphabetical order, and correct a subject-verb disagreement in her original question. Our phones were ringing like a Save the Whales telethon back then. Inquiring teachers wanted to know, how could such a skinny little kid be filled with so much hatred and contempt? Backtalkers don't win many blacktop boxing matches. Scrawny arms raised for throwing sand and exacting scratches because educated fourth grade playground mercenaries know creating pain is easier than creating. White boys narrower than Urkel. This imagination's fertile, but you can't fit a square into a social circle. Though stuffed into a locker, one tends to get philosophical. Blood black and blue do make a pretty shade of purple. In seventh grade, I scrawled Neanderthal across Takashi's locker with a Sharpie after he lit my hair on fire to see what it would smell like. I left a couple blazing trails on the asphalt when he tore after me during lunch. could have been friends, but nerds with vendettas offend, and God prefers burning a vandal on both ends. Melted wax poetics, doing lines of Shakespeare in the bathroom with a library card and a twisty straw. That lightweight Hulk Hogan who can't bench press the Wheaties box his face is on. I don't think I need remind anyone of my famous last stand in middle school. The post-PE face-off in the hallway Mr. Minchell and his whistle blocking the exit, my boombox was the only one that ever stuck by my side, so I cranked the janky Credo Blaster to 10. If you wanna go and get high with me, smoking L in the back of the Benzie. You remember the song I started rhyming over the top of his head. Can't remember exactly what was said, just that it was epic. Brought in references to Machiavelli and post-Civil War Reconstructionism. Every phrase had a sneaky metaphor and three punchlines, and soon a crowd gathered to bear witness, and I was like, got more sauce than shoyu. Some kid fainted. Watch your back, cause I'll lyrically destroy you. Oh! Next thing I know, Officer Krupke is reading me my Miranda rights in the principal's office. Apparently, according to state penal code, lyrical destruction is still a threat and a federal offense. Every time I tell my friends the story, I leave out the tear that hits the ground in front of my chair. The sobs struggling to get out of my throat. That lightweight, light-skinned grandmaster of emotional repression. I know what you're all thinking, and please, don't tell anyone. Thank you. This next poem is called Half-Life. It's a reworking of a previous poem, and I consider all of my poems works in progress. Half-Life. Grandma likes to remind us of the importance of the holidays. If you don't nail it when God is watching you closest, how are you supposed to get it right the rest of the time? I forgot Hanukkah this year. Sat in my room watching Three's Company reruns. The Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost until I came downstairs and saw Dad packing up the menorah on day 9. I forgot Passover last year and the year before that, and I just found out Yom Kippur existed. Thought the Festival of Lights was the electrical parade down Main Street in Disneyland. I can still shut my eyes and see Rabbi Silver holding hands with Dopey. I suppose it wouldn't be so bad if I were a goy. Came from a Baptist mishpocha and asked for my daily leavened bread during the holidays. I suppose it wouldn't be so bad if I wasn't Jewish. Well, half-Jewish. But I've only been to one bar mitzvah. It wasn't mine. And to be honest, I was only there for the candy. Sometimes I get concerned that my Gentile half-life lasts 365 days a year. I think if half-Jewish meant I only had to remember half the holidays, I might be a little more motivated. If it meant my left hand only knew what my right hand said, so with my right I'd hold the Torah and my left I'd raise the dead, or I could half believe in Jesus and half believe he's fraud and believe the Red Sea opened just for half the Jews at a cross, I'd be a model Jew, built to half scale. But I can't picture myself with a yarmulke and curly sideburns pounding scripture and Jägermeister at a bar mitzvah with an after party at the Hustler Club. I tend to have more sobering fantasies. Standing at the altar, altering the Torah and dishonoring decorum. Baruch, Atah, I don't know, Elevator Melancholy, Chomsky Gnome, Shecheyanu, Vikings, Randy Moss, and Super Bowl. I forgot Hanukkah this year, and there's no one to potch the lek out of my mouth or sew up the holes in my reasoning. I've been thinking, if a full Jew comes of age at 13, then maybe I've been a man since 6 and a half, and I can blame my forgetfulness on Alzheimer's. Or I could get faded at the Seder, drink a fifth of Manischewitz and an eighth of tequila, slurring words until I can't sing Hafa, Nagila, crying to my borscht that I'm just half and half that make a hole for me to crawl into and die, but I'm just overthinking, all too alive and kicking, and lately my heart hasn't been beating my head to the punch. My cranium, my atrium, my temple is my temple, my skull is my confession booth. I can't admit the real problem to myself, that if I remembered 8 Hanukkahs a year, it wouldn't make me a mensch. Root cellars hoard relics. I keep mine in the back of my mind. A piece of Moses' collarbone. My bris. My grandma Sid. And Hanukkah. Next year. Thank you. This last poem is called Same Page. The easy answers always have a catch. Strike a match and watch good intentions wing themselves out windows like frightened bats. It's easy to wax that we got the top tax bracket throwing up food stamps for backup and insisting that the world is flat. Saying screw welfare, screw Copernicus. Everything I need to know I learned in business school and the campus lawn definitely didn't bend over the horizon. It's easy for post-grads to point to their maps in their textbook atlas as proof. Explain that in the Mercator projection, South America and Africa are practically the size of England. That the world is flat in a map, in an atlas, in a classroom in Massachusetts, and you can't fit the planet on the same page. It's too easy to soak up the sun in Martha's Vineyard on the Atlantic and let the Western Hemisphere run Euro-concentric circles around the rest of the planet, asking, why run when we can fly? It's easy for jet-setters to litter out the window above the globe like cabin pressure was a metaphor for Lincoln's American dream blown open so we can go and dump trash into the ocean and stratosphere and buy it back wrapped in plastic and glass shards bartered from Ghana. Pawned off on Rwanda. Why can't the mall rats in Nowhere, Nevada drop her shopping bags and wrap her arms around the kid who stitched her Prada? Because odds are a sweatshop worker in Togo used his last thread of dignity to sew the logo on my polo. I've been to summer homes filled with kids fitted in Manolo from Lesotho who don't know that Nagasaki is not the hot new sushi shop in Soho, that their Reeboks didn't walk themselves down the assembly line. And I'd like to tell myself, maybe if every laborer went on strike and the boxes from Foot Locker came with disassembled footwear, like, here's an idea. I could call it my own do-it-yourself shoe store, Nikea. Workers bent over in prayer in a sentiment Adam is animate in 'em. This is bad religion, a back of the classroom note tied to the leg of a pigeon, a pipe dream, a fly dream. Like maybe jet setters will abandon aircraft and hop on the backs of doves, the backs of frightened bats, rise above the cumulus and toss accumulated stacks of greenbacks off the backs to the masses gathered below. And I try to tell myself, if the yen can rise above the dollar, if the euro can rise above the dollar, if the Swiss franc can rise above the dollar, then so can we. I see Alan Greenspan in my Nikea paying for Cortez's with pesos, the Messiah at the top of the G8 summit rocking a sermon, a poetry slam in Mozambique with folks spitting in Swahili, and Mayor Gavin Newsom repaving a pothole in Thailand. America is not an island, and you can't fit the world on the same page. Thank you.
Thank you for inviting me, John. One slight clarification. These days I'm pretty much exclusively writing Western-style poetry. When it comes to Japanese side of the street, I've been working on a set of translations of the haiku poet Santoka with partner in Kawasaki, Emiko Miyashita, and these will be out probably in a month or two, published by Pia Books. My first poem is entitled Irish Landscape with Spouse. A good disposition has taken the hotel 17-year-old spaniel quite some distance. Presently, out to the bench at the head of a little cement dock, to the woman in her blue sweater, who dislikes canines for their noxious odors, unappetizing hair, servility, barking, snappishness, who has been studying her maps, gazing seaward along the rock-bound cove. His legs work poorly, making the dog bounce and wriggle, though he can move fast enough. A matted, brown and white coat and the red growth under his eye don't help, nor do creaky moans beseeching love. The morning deliciously quiet, a sailboat slightly turning around its mooring. She prefers the ways of cats, but pets him anyhow. Thank you. Cumbersome. Crayfish out of water. Doomed undoubtedly by going missing from my son's bedroom aquarium. Crawled out somehow, desperate and willing to perish, escaping the name imposed by an observant 6-year-old boy still mourning a week later, when Cumbersome, all tarted up with dust bunnies, crept forth from the refrigerator's drip pan netherworld, having eluded Kitty Laverne and Minnie Marco Polo'd, trekking a long hall's distance to the stairs, clawing and bouncing down one flight, retracing half a house length, then navigating the linoleum's slippery expanse. Astonishing and understated, all at once, he couldn't roam again, what with the weighted screen above his head. Cumbersome died, a crustacean Methuselah. Never uttering an audible word, he wrote his true name large. The next two poems are from a running chapbook manuscript dealing with the U.S. conquest of the Middle East. The first was written shortly after shock and awe, when from the deck of a carrier in the Persian Gulf, our esteemed president proclaimed victory. It's all over but the shooting, the throat cutting, the poisoning, the interrogations, show trials, imprisonments, the physical rehabilitations, prostheses, the infrastructure upgrades, the profiteering, the quislings, the factions, the propaganda, the stage-managed elections, the boundary disputes, vendettas, assassinations, suicide bombings, indifference, neglect, abandonment. All over today, all over Iraq. This second piece dates from a year or so later. Easter Sunday, 2004. It's been one hell of a party, judging by the dead soldiers. 106 packs and still counting. Jesus got up early, wandered off, big things on his mind, as usual. Always too big to tidy up the living room, empty a few ashtrays in Iraq. But like they say, he's generous, authorizes any fool to sign checks in his name. Noticeable from the lawn. The long-gone tenant, a romantic, slight, subtly beautiful woman, seemed depressed between boyfriends. One, a house painter, superimposed a red heart on the white arch curving over the porch steps. They broke up. She moved years ago. His love cartoon survives, even in this time of thieves and fanatics. Has she a boyfriend now? Does he possess a heart? Thank you. Next is a kind of list poem inspired by a magazine insert in my Sunday paper. What People Earn. Cover story from Parade, 3/13/05. Our tax season Sunday sermon, proto-poem and demographic orgy. 137 inch square faces, places, ages, occupations, incomes, the whole materialist shooting match. In an oracular, punchy format that simultaneously discloses everything and or nothing. While it's gratifying to read SpongeBob, ageless, raked in $1.2 billion, kudos, SB, Katie Clark, 21, a North Vegas danseuse, body not shown, couldn't crack 30 thou. Call that earning? Annualized, how much are you worth? Idaho archaeologist Steve Armstrong, 40, says $53,000. Christopher Ivey, age 51, highway maintenance of Belleville Ill, 29, whereas Teresa Daugherty, a bravely smiling New Jersey school bus driver, tallies 26. One of my favorites, the spunky L.A. actress Renee Zellweger, only racks up 21. Just kidding, million. What do you say to that, towboat Captain Tom Miller, 40 Ponce de Leon Fla, sitting on a squalid 85, or you, Fresno Mike McNeely, 30, Deputy D.A., 51 large? Where's the justice, after stuffing scads of scumbags into cells? Alfred Cosina busts his ass running an Hawaiian coffee company to realize 50. Al can't hardly afford pineapple poo-poos at the WikiWalk. And Yevgenia C., layaway clerk up by Fairbanks, A.K., good for a cool 17.5, should try loving the real estate racket. Clue her in, M.B. Gourlay, Wilmington, Delaware, mortgage financier who pulled 280,000 little green ones out of her hat, while Gualberto Medina, Jersey broker, trundled home with a jolly 600. Feeling prime, N.G., Pittsburgh secretary, about year 23? Or you, Tracy Gregory, environmental tech, gleaning a measly 28? Did you squeeze yourself dry as SpongeBob? Sweat blood like Angelino Lindsay Lohan, 18, over her 10 mil? No way. Not unless you've stared yourself in the eye and commanded you measure up, rock, kick butt, cut mustard, put your shoulder to the wheel, suck in your gut and salute for 65, such as Zach R., 36, U.S. Army Specialist, First Class, who we trust remains alive, a success in itself. I'll finish up with the piece that started with a dozen words pulled out of a hat at a writing workshop. By chance, almost all were names of animals. The final two words, toad and fever, provided my title. Toad fever. No one at first believed Blue Jay, even though sometimes he told the truth. It felt better to say, sure, right, BS, says you, then sort out details garbled by bird-to-bird transmission. Details even more implausible than when he waxed hysterical over a huge floppy-eared monster with a strangled snake for a nose, a snake where an inquisitive rodent got stuck. For that nonsense, we laughed him out of our neighborhood, and for a few months it was nice and quiet. This time around, if we'd listened, we might have laid in vaccine or lined up hospital beds. But when he started shrieking about what he called a cheater, an impossibly fast animal that broke out in spots and stripes and rolled over dead, we just smirked. Not a laughing matter, he sputtered. It's headed our way. Which made him so much funnier, until Mountain Lion Joe, stiff as a board, turned up covered with the kind of blotches a confused bird might call stripes. That's toad fever, hollered the jay. Several charitable animals, who reminded us of Joe's hard luck, speculated the marks could have once been tattoos. Others blamed his lifestyle, insinuated he did things to deer and sheep before eating them, wondered if he ever worked toad into his appetite. Uncooperative, the toads argued they still hadn't lived down the Egyptian mess and could do without fresh scandals. These toads, tight-lipped most of the time anyway, dreaded scientific research, quarantines, witch hunts. Tough, snarled Blue Jay. We've all got things to worry about now.
This ends Mystic Babylon's Poetry Podcast. I hope you can come back in 2 weeks and you have enjoyed this podcast. Thank you very much.